Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. Ronit Avni is an activist, filmmaker, and founder of Just Vision, an organization dedicated to educating people about nonviolent solutions to the conflict in the Middle East. Her most recent film is Budrus, which is about the joint efforts of Palestinians and Israelis to save the lands of a Palestinian village from being destroyed by Israel's separation barrier. And here's our conversation.
So the work you do, I'm very curious as to how you came to it. How did you come to the consciousness that brought you to this movement about nonviolence and peace and social justice in Israel?
Sure. It's funny because I originally wanted nothing to do with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I grew up in an expat Israeli community. My community, not my family, was fairly conservative and closed-minded politically. Mm-hmm. You know, we had teachers in my school, my Jewish school growing up, that would say really outrageous things, often racist things. I had one teacher who would say things like, a good Arab is a dead Arab, in class. And I just wanted out of that whole dynamic. And so I didn't think I would deal with this issue at all. And then a friend of mine took me, suggested that I audit a Middle Eastern studies class in college. And I was very reluctant, but it just was a fluke of scheduling that I happened to do it. And I just got hooked. And as I suddenly started to see all of the things that my educators had not had the maturity and the ability to convey to me about the history of the region, about the politics, all of the multi-leveled nuance of it, I became really obsessed with learning everything that I could. And that's when I started to dive in. I got an internship with B'Tselem, the largest Israeli human rights organization working in the occupied territories. I volunteered with the Public Committee Against Torture in Israel and really started to educate myself. I come from an artistic background, so I wanted to fuse documentary film and human rights work. And that actually led me to a job at Peter Gabriel's human rights organization, Witness, which was based in New York, but also continued to work with Israeli and Palestinian human rights advocates there.
So the work itself, I'm fascinated by the, when I was over the weekend looking at Just Vision, your organization, your website, and you have this series of images of not just women, but mainly women who are active in nonviolent struggles in Israel. You're 10 unsung visionaries, and they look like incredible human beings. I mean, Ethiopian Jews and Jews of Arab descent and the rest. I mean, that's a piece of what is going on that we never hear nor talk about in the news, in the media. I mean, you think it does not exist.
Mm-hmm. So when I was at Witness, after September 11th happened, I decided that I wanted, and after the collapse of the Oslo process, I wanted to work in my own backyard. And so I spent 2 years interviewing 475 Israelis and Palestinians engaged in nonviolence, conflict resolution work, and human rights advocacy. And informally, there was nothing academic or scientific about the interviews, but I would ask them, you know, how they got to where they are, what they were doing, why they were doing it, and what they needed, what was missing. And overwhelmingly, the response that I got from them was that they felt invisible. They felt that people didn't know they existed. They felt isolated. They wanted to know who else was out there. And don't forget, you know, this was between 2001, 2003, so most people didn't have websites about their work at the time. And they felt that the international community just wasn't there to have their back. And so Just Vision, the organization, emerged to tell their stories, to support and highlight the work of both Palestinians and Israelis engaged in nonviolence and conflict resolution. And the idea is not to tell nice stories about the region at all, but it is to look at how ordinary people have agency, how they have more power than they think, how they have the possibility to contribute to resolving this conflict, and what they're doing, the very, very diverse ways that they're engaged. And it's true that a lot of the people doing this work are women. We don't focus exclusively on women, but certainly many of the people behind the scenes who aren't necessarily the spokespeople, they're not at the front, are often women who are doing really critical work. And so we try to really surface those models so people can either join them, support them, or if they don't like what they see, they can reject the models and innovate on them, but they're doing it from a place of knowledge.
So it's interesting to me on a number of levels here. I mean, because what we hear in the United States are stories about conflict, about Israelis and Palestinians, about the hatred that exists, and it does exist. I mean, there are people who I love in Israel who are incredible artists, and they mention a Palestinian, and they spit on the floor. I mean, that there is there too. But these stories, I think, are ones that, have, I mean, it, how important it is for these stories, for the world to hear these stories, just because they would represent something different and growing that is absolutely, as I said a moment ago, invisible.
Absolutely. I think that Egypt and Tunisia right now demonstrate, I mean, there were people who've been working on building a democratic and nonviolent movement in Egypt for several years now, the April 6th movement, for instance. And, you know, we tend to not pay attention to civil society initiatives until they become, where you just can't ignore them anymore. And I think we need to get on board a little bit earlier and recognize those really constructive voices, because those are the people ultimately that often lead changes, whether it was the civil rights movement, the environmental movement, feminism. I mean, if we think of the major, significant, historic movements of the last century, those all came from the bottom up. They didn't come from the top down. And yet we've had a tendency, especially in the Middle East, to look at it through a lens of top down. And I think events in the last few months, regardless of how they end up turning out down the line, I think have really reminded us of the power of ordinary people and the fact that we can't ignore civil society, that they're really critical in the future of the region.
So what do you think? I mean, not that you're prescient, no one is, but that this grassroots movement growing from the bottom in many places, from the film you did, Budrus to Belind, and the others, where do you see that going? How do you see that evolving and moving, since it is a minority and it's unseen by most?
It's messy and yet very important. I think over the last number of years, you're seeing a growing belief in Palestinian society in the power of nonviolent struggle that involves internationals and Israelis. So during the first Intifada, many Palestinians struggled nonviolently. There were boycotts and strikes and sit-ins, things that I, growing up, didn't learn about. All I saw were the iconic images of stone throwing and masked people and, you know, Molotov cocktails and the killing of collaborators. Well, that happened later, but during the first Intifada, it was, you know, there were those images of the stone throwing and the Molotov cocktails. But what I didn't see, and what was really eye-opening for me going back to do the research for Budrus and for our work, was to look at footage of women leading marches during the first Intifada and all of these strikes and all of these kind of classic nonviolent tactics and strategies that just didn't translate to me. There wasn't the internet at the time. There wasn't the globalized media environment that there is today. So it's been a learning curve for me, because for Israelis, there's this sense that Palestinians have never adopted nonviolence. And for Palestinians, there's a sense that they tried it and it failed. And there's a big gap in perception between the two societies. And so I think in the last number of years, there has been fatigue with the armed efforts at ending the occupation in Palestinian society and a growing tendency to move towards these nonviolent movements. But they've been very localized, so often they're village-based, often they're dealing with an acute crisis, whether a community might lose its lands or they don't have access to the local water well anymore or a settlement is encroaching on their property. It hasn't yet translated into a national movement. And it's a question as to whether it can or can't. There are elements both within the Palestinian Authority and the Israeli government and military that fear a nonviolent movement emerging, because nonviolence is messy, it's chaotic, it's hard to control. You don't know what happens the next day, I mean, as we're seeing in parts of the region. So it's very hard to predict. You know, the thing that I will say that is critical for us to pay attention to is that today there is a crackdown on some of these nonviolence leaders. And these are people who believe in Israelis and Palestinians coming together. They believe in freedom and security and dignity for both populations. They believe in inclusivity in terms of involving women and men in this process. And we've seen it in action over the last number of years. And some of them are really facing, you know, jail sentences, tough fines. They're facing really
difficult... From both sides? From the Palestinian Authority and the Israelis as well?
Well, most of the crackdown is happening right now by the Israeli government, but there is also repression coming from the PA vis-a-vis some of these activists. So these are people we can't afford to ignore, because at the end of the day, they're going to be the best neighbors that these two societies are going to have. They already have deep ties of trust between the communities. We've seen it as we've taken our film Boudrous from village to village in Palestinian society, and also in cinematheques and universities in Israel. We deal very frequently with both societies because our team is a mixed team, Israeli and Palestinian. And we see the incredible relations of trust that have emerged among this subset of the populations, this kind of activist community. And obviously it's a minority, but that was true in the civil rights movement as well. I mean, the precursor to it, where you had whites and blacks coming together in an environment where that was societally incredibly difficult, that was a precursor to a larger movement that ultimately was an inclusive movement. And I think, you know, my hope is that we nurture and foster those voices as opposed to the militant and the maximalists, who first of all advocate the use of violence and also don't see a place for the two societies in the region.
I mean, there's a powerful piece in all through the film, Boudrous Tebboune, the pieces I've seen, where the voices of Hamas and Fatah and Israelis are kind of coming together, which, and I as I was thinking, looking at that, I was wondering, I mean, is that, and people look at that and go, is that real? Is that
right? Yeah.
Is it this isolated
right
village, or is it something that is kind of infecting the souls of the people beyond that?
It's amazing that you don't see these images. We don't see them in the nightly news. I mean, the fact that in Boudrous, so just to set the scene, Boudrous is a village in the West Bank, and it was going to lose much of its lands because the Israeli government was building a separation barrier, which they were advocating for security reasons, and Palestinians saw it as more of a land grab. So there's differences in opinion for the reasons that it emerged, but the government was planning to build it through the village, and the villagers united in a nonviolent strategy to try to prevent construction of the barrier. That involved Fatah, Hamas, all the political factions, and they also welcomed Israelis. And I think my favorite moment in the film, or one of them, is when Ahmed Awad, the leader of Hamas in Boudrous, welcomes the Israelis. And you see he processes the cognitive dissonance for him to have Israelis that are standing with him and advocating for Palestinian rights. He's never seen anything like it. And at the same time, here is a man who's advocating a nonviolent strategy, who is a member of Hamas. So all of these images are cognitive dissonance for most of us, because
for you too, when you first saw it?
Well, I mean, I think the welcoming of Israelis went above and beyond. I mean, there's one thing to kind of adopt a nonviolent strategy and be fine with the Israeli presence, but to actually proactively welcome them to the village was something that I was moved by, for sure. And, you know, we've gone back to the village to show the film, and all of the political factions came, the Israelis came. I mean, they were all there. There was over 800 people in the village watching the film and cheering and chanting. So those relations of trust continue until this day. And, you know, I sat down with Iltizam, the main female protagonist, the 15-year-old girl of the film, in Dubai, and she was talking about how she was challenging anti-Semitism in Bosnia, where she currently studies medicine, as a result of meeting Israelis who came and defended her rights and championed the rights of the Palestinian people. So these bonds of trust, they're very deep, and they last beyond the immediacy of the situation at hand. That being said, you know, I don't want to overstate this movement. It's still a small and growing movement. But most families, I mean, most Israeli families, you know, will have a settler in the family. They'll have a left-wing activist in the family. I mean, you know, it's a diverse people. And that's true of Palestinians as well. So Ayad Morar, the main protagonist, who's a member of Fatah, and is in no way sympathetic to the platforms of Hamas. But some of his brothers are Hamas members. And so even in families, you have that diversity. So it's been too simplistic for us to draw these red lines and pretend that we can separate out these segments of either society, either Israeli or Palestinian. They're part and parcel whether we like it or not. And then for me, the question is, how do you get people to rally around nonviolent approaches that are inclusive, that are pluralistic? And, you know, and if you can get people to do that, no matter who they are, that's ultimately a positive. And it's not like the Israelis and Fatah were co-opted by the Hamas strategy. It's that they all came together in service of a common goal, which was to save the lands without causing harm to Israeli security. So It's growing. It's not there yet. I think it's going to need a lot of support. I think like Egypt and Tunisia, it's going to take everybody. Egypt would not have succeeded if it was just a small subgroup. But, you know, getting from here to there is going to be a long and very difficult journey. And the people who are leading the way are incredibly courageous. Many have been sent to prison, sometimes repeatedly. They've faced very difficult circumstances. They recognize the toll that this approach is going to take on their families and communities, and yet they believe in it.
I was interviewing some young Palestinian hip-hop artists, some of which actually live in the States now and go back and forth, and they're Palestinians who live inside of Israel. And we had this conversation about how, as a young man, I looked at Zionism as a liberation movement and where that came from and what happened since. But they have a lot of anger, obviously, about their social condition, about their oppression. And that anger just boils up easily, I mean, just because of what happens. And then that... I thought about this film and these people and the world that has to be kind of overcome to make this work. This is a long haul. This is not something that will happen tomorrow morning.
It is a long haul, and I think that we have to have a very long historical view on many movements. I mean, I think the civil rights movement is one I keep turning to for my own source of strength, because, you know, it was building block upon building block for decades and centuries, frankly, that have gotten us to where we are today, and we're still not there yet. You know, it may be that recent events are going to catalyze changes that had been unforeseen until now because of the regional shifts. But it's a long haul. I think that the people who are involved have no illusion that it's going to be quick or it's going to be easy. I think the media and I think our policymakers and thought leaders need to pay more attention is to civil society, because if they're only dealing with these political figureheads, that's unsustainable, particularly when those figureheads don't have the local support and legitimacy and trust of the communities. And I think the reason why Boudrous was able to succeed was because the people leading the way were of the community. They were from the community. They were respected within the community, trusted, and they were putting the needs of the community first, and they were able to rally the community around a very difficult strategy. I mean, they could have been killed. You know, Iltizam jumped in front of a bulldozer to prevent the uprooting of olive trees not too far after Rachel Corrie had been killed. I mean, so people have been killed, and I believe that there have been 26 casualties in the broader nonviolence movement in Palestinian society since it began, not in Boudrous, but in other villages where people have been hit by tear gas canisters and really hurt. So it's a strategy that requires a lot of strength and a lot of patience.
It seems it's also something that has to somehow permeate and influence the larger communities that don't trust, the larger communities that are walled in for lots of reasons. They're walled in on both sides. They're terrified to hear this.
Absolutely. One of the reasons we use film is because it's a great way to reach unusual communities. So, for instance, we had a screening of Boudrous in Gaza, and we saw from some of the reactions we got and some of the blog posts afterwards, people were absolutely astonished by the Israeli activists. They had never seen Israelis putting their bodies on the line nonviolently to protect Palestinian lands. And they wanted to know more. There was a curiosity and a hunger, you know, and we see that also in Israeli society, where people have never seen women like Iltizam, the 15-year-old girl who led the women's movement that turned around a situation that was failing into one that actually had a chance for success. They haven't seen somebody like that, you know, who is able to mobilize women, to have a community where the women are in the front of this very conservative Palestinian village, as I had described. Describes it, you know, those are his terms. So yes, I think, you know, we use film very intentionally to try to reach out way beyond people who are already on board with this message. And we've been taking the film, you know, to cinematheques across Israel, you know, Sderot, for example. We showed the film at a cinematheque, and there were several soldiers who had been stationed in Budrus in the audience, and it was wonderful because they stayed.
What did they say?
We had a 90-minute discussion afterwards about what is the appropriate role in the face of this kind of movement? What is an ethical response? And, you know, these are important questions to be asked. I actually sat with Yasmin Levy, the Israeli border police woman who appears
in the
film. And I sat with her and I showed her the film, and afterwards we talked a little bit, and she said she felt it was fair. And
felt the film was fair.
The film was fair. She was very positive about it. She felt it was objective. And she said, you know, after Budrus, she was stationed in the village of Bilin, and after Bilin, she had to remove settlers from Gaza. And in each of those instances, she felt she was doing her job as a soldier. And it was interesting to me that she put those three situations together and equated them in her mind.
When you do these things, I mean, do you end up, does it fuel you in terms of where you think we may be able to go?
They are the people that I meet, these incredibly courageous individuals, are my anchor on this issue, because once you've seen Israelis and Palestinians who are willing to put their bodies on the line nonviolently, who are willing to advocate on behalf of the other. And we see it in all kinds of domains. I mean, there are Palestinians who've led trips to Auschwitz, you know, to show their communities about the history of the Holocaust, you know, where you see Israelis who are willing to stand up to soldiers with their bodies, where you see Palestinians protecting, like in the film, there's a beautiful scene where the Palestinians are protecting the Israelis from being arrested by the Israeli army. I mean, you know, when you see the level of relationship that's being built around common purpose, which is freedom, which is human dignity, and which is for the two societies to be there to stay, you can't go back. Nobody can shake your belief in the fact that there are Israelis and Palestinians out there committed to these values. They may not be in the majority. They may not be in you know, the dominant political, you know, they may not be dominant at the moment. But the fact that they exist and that they're attracting more people to their circles is significant, and that's frankly how social change has happened historically. Mm-hmm. So yes, I derive tremendous strength and fuel from their courage.
Well, the media is powerful, and these images have to kind of melt their way into the media somehow to be seen by a larger world. That consciousness has to begin to change.
Absolutely. You know, it's very funny thinking back to our world premiere of the film Budrus was at the Dubai International Film Festival. And first night, the red carpet gala was Avatar. And the second night, the red carpet gala was Budrus.
That's an interesting balance.
And it was very interesting because there was an Egyptian journalist in the audience, and he wrote a piece that he concocted. It was completely fiction about Ayed accusing him of being a collaborator because he simply didn't believe that nonviolence could achieve political results. This was an Egyptian journalist. And it's amazing to me now to think of where we are since December 2009, that is not going to happen in the near future. You know, that people now see the power of nonviolence. Now, whether, you know, whether the planning is in place and the pieces are in place to make that sustainable, I'm obviously very hopeful, and I wish the Egyptian people and the Tunisian people the best of luck. But the very the fact of the power of nonviolence in achieving change, I think, is now something that's really in the consciousness of millions more people than it had been previously.
There's no question. And people begin to realize that this was not something that happened just overnight in Cairo or in Tunisia or in many other places. This has been an international movement that's been planning, growing, building, teaching, training.
Exactly. Exchanging strategies and tactics. Absolutely.
For a long time.
Yeah.
Just for our listeners, again, Just Vision, and I'm just curious about the power you think lives in the work that you do and lives in the idea of how to use media and use documentary to begin to change consciousness and make us wrestle with things.
We use media because it's a great way to transport people into another world, into a place that they may not have physically come into contact with, to create empathy and to put themselves in the shoes of other people. And that's really been a powerful force with both of our documentaries, both in Counterpoint and Budrus, and, you know, and also the interviews that we publish on our website on justvision.org. You know, storytelling, I think, is so primal. It's so central to all of our cultures and to our history. And seeing people going through these processes and these journeys and the challenges that they face, you gain insight into what it takes to do what they're doing, but you also gain, I think, respect and some connection and some empathy for the people involved. And that's true whether you're Palestinian watching Israelis or you're Israeli watching Palestinians. I mean, all of our work is focused on a few central themes. It's about, if you're not a militant, if you're not a militarist, if you're not a politician, what can you do? So it's about this idea that ordinary people have more power than they think. The second pillar is that nonviolence is the best way to do it. And then the third is that, you know, working cooperatively and across lines and learning from the experiences of others is really critical. So the people that we showcase are people that have been able to cross those boundaries in different ways. They're not doing it just to make nice and, you know, hug each other and kind of let the status quo continue. Exactly.
The rest of the world, right?
They're challenging the occupation. They're working towards resolving the conflict. But they're doing it recognizing that both Israelis and Palestinians have a powerful role to play in that process.
And so what comes next for Ronit Avni? What's the next on the agenda here?
Well, there's ongoing work that we do. We have an office in East Jerusalem in Sheikh Jarrah and also in Washington, New York. So we're doing outreach around the film Budrus. It's opening still in theaters across the United States. It's also starting to screen in campuses and community settings in places of worship. In Israel, it continues to be screened to thought leaders, to journalists, universities, cinematheques, and Palestinian society. We're going village by village, women's group by women's group, the police academy. I mean, there's a whole roster of places. We're talking about reaching out to the political leadership in Israel and also in the Palestinian Authority. We've had a screening in Congress. We're scheduling one for the UN coming up here in the United States. Next, we have a film coming out, hopefully by the early fall, about Sheikh Jarrah, about East Jerusalem, and there's been a movement of Israelis together with East Jerusalemite Palestinians to really make sure that the Palestinian presence in East Jerusalem is not overrun by settlers that are trying to push them out. And it's a very interesting movement that has emerged over the last few years that's actually brought in more of the mainstream Israeli public, iconic authors and members of parliament and, you know, figures who may not have gone into a village like Budrus in the West Bank, but are showing up in Sheikh Jarrah. So we do have a film coming out about that movement. And then we're researching our next pieces, so we'll see.
So as we conclude, I'm in where all this can take your work and Israel and Palestinians. You wrote a piece in the Washington Post I read about the settlers and settlements. And it seems to me that is such a critical piece of where all this goes.
Yes.
I'm curious, A, about your viewpoint and how you think this next piece you're working that's coming out addresses that issue, because that clearly is a...
Well, to me, the settlement question is a huge obstacle to resolving the conflict. And, you know, Just Vision as an organization, we don't prescribe policy, we don't draw the lines, we don't suggest final borders, but we do see the settlements and settlers as an obstacle to resolving the conflict. Obviously, they're part of Israeli society, so they're going to need to be taken into account, just as members of Hamas and other political factions in Palestinian society need to be included in the process. But, you know, I would love to see... I'd love to see the Israeli government recognize that it's on a path right now that's an unsustainable path, and for us all to try to turn the situation around a little bit so that we can remove the obstacles to resolving the conflict while keeping the dignity of the populations intact. And we're not there yet.
It's been a pleasure. Ronit, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Ronit Avni of Just Vision, recorded earlier this week in Washington, D.C. Don't go away, because the Mark Steiner Show will be right back with our interview with Dr. Bernard Avishai. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555.